Hello and welcome to the Eating Disorder Therapist podcast. This is a podcast to help you find peace with food and overcome disordered eating. And I'm Harriet Frew, aka the Eating Disorder Therapist. And I'm so excited to share with you all kinds of stories, tips, information and guest interviews to help you on your journey in finding peace with food. So thank you so much for listening today. Now today I have a guest on the show and I am talking to Anique Besso, who is a registered dietitian who specializes in treating individuals with eating disorders and offering guidance to athletes when it comes to sports nutrition and relative energy deficiency in sport. Anique is based in Quebec, Canada. Anique applies therapeutic modalities and principles of health at every size and intuitive eating to her nutritional recommendations to assist clients in developing more effective relationships with food and their bodies. Anique identifies what clients value in order to explore how present behaviors interfere with achieving their goals. Because of her love of sport, Anique also has an interest in sports nutrition, and she specializes in the treatment of relative energy deficiency in sport, micronutrient deficiencies in sport, and fueling to optimize recovery and performance. Anique is also bilingual in French and English. So today in this episode, Anique is going to talk about her journey into working in eating disorders and sports nutrition. And then she's going to explore what it means to provide trauma-informed nutritional care to people with eating disorders. She'll explore motivation for change and understanding the deeper meaning of an eating disorder as a coping strategy. She explores creative approaches in supporting her clients, including cooking and going out to restaurants. And she talks about grounding techniques to calm the nervous system and how she works to provide individual and person-centered care in her practice. Now, Anique is a really inspiring human who clearly is absolutely passionate about what she does. There's so much value in this episode. Let's get to the conversation. Time for a short advertisement break. I can remember crying in the doctor's surgery 4 years into living with bulimia. I was desperate for help and wanted support to escape the torturous cycle of restriction, binge eating and purging. My face was swollen, my stomach ached and I felt lonely and desperate, and I was told that the local ED service had closed and that there was no help available. I left at the time, dejected and lost. And it wasn't until 2 years later, when out in Australia, still struggling with the illness, that I made the decision to support others in the way that I had not been supported. And I decided that I would train as a counsellor and support others in eating disorder recovery. And at age 25 years old, I began this process. Starting in the NHS Eating Disorder Service in Cambridge and in private practice later in my 20s, I was able to put my dream into a reality. Seeing clients, families, teaching, and in more recent years, social media, blogging, podcasting, training and supervising counsellors, I continue to be incredibly passionate about my work. But my latest offering is my Breaking Free from Bulimia online course. It's 12 steps and it's packed full of valuable tools and strategies to help you break free. You'll start with understanding and making sense of your past and why you're struggling. You'll then work on motivation to change and root out the ambivalence and fear of letting go. You'll dive into the destructive impact of diet culture and get firmly in your own recovery lane. You'll practice regular eating and stabilizing blood sugar levels to create a strong baseline for recovery, and you'll interrupt the binge and purge cycle. With support, you'll introduce your old forbidden foods and practice self-compassion techniques to become much kinder and supportive of yourself. You'll work on emotional eating and challenging your negative thoughts. And there's modules on finding your voice and becoming assertive, plus developing robust self-esteem and managing relapse with ease and continuing on the recovery road. 12 modules, self-paced, online, delivered in lecture and video content by me, Harriet Frew, expert by experience, having recovered myself from bulimia and having worked in the NHS and private practice with clients with eating disorders for 20 years. Link is in the show notes. And sign up by April the 30th and gain 20% off the full price of £99. It's fantastic value. It's the toolkit you need. Sign up today. Step into freedom with food and living the life that you want. No more restrictions, secret behaviours, shame and loneliness. Break free from bulimia today. Hi, Anique. Welcome to the Eating Disorder Therapist podcast.
Hi, Harriet. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, really excited to have you here. Can I get you firstly to introduce yourself to the listeners, please?
Yes. So my name is Anique. I'm a registered dietitian. I see people in Canada and in the United States. And I actually went into dietetics specifically to treat eating disorders In high school, I had the experience of being treated for an eating disorder, and it really did guide my career path. So I went into dietetics, then got a master's in dietetics as well, and then had the opportunity to work both in Montreal, Canada, and then I worked in Washington, D.C. for a few years as well, and then came back and opened a group practice in Montreal. And now we're a team of about, I always forget, but between 10 and 15 people now.
Right. Wow. Oh, amazing. I came to Montreal, I think in like, goodness knows, many, many years ago. I worked on a camp, summer camp in Connecticut. And I went up to Montreal to visit a friend who was also on camp like many, many years ago. I think it's probably in the late 90s, which just really shows how ancient I am. But tell us a bit about Montreal and just for the listeners to get a bit of a sense of what it's like.
Yeah, Montreal is incredible. People describe it as very European because we have the Quebecois culture that is very unique. But then there are a lot of Anglophones in Montreal as well, because we have a few big universities. So Montreal, I would say people work to live rather than live to work. So we have, as we say in French, like a joie de vivre. We like going out for good food and drinks and being in parks, having fun. So the city itself is just wonderful because it's a nice mix of a lot of great restaurants, great shops, but also there's the mountain and there's a lot of greenery.
Lovely. Yeah. And I think you really kind of captured the vibe really nicely there. Does it help with all the kind of self-care and like looking after yourself and all of that being in that environment that is a bit more permissive around perhaps enjoying life and living rather than being work, 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 work all the time?
I do think so. So, of course, we have an eating disorder clinic. So there are, of course, these pressures and the vulnerabilities that are cultural. But I would say in comparing my experience when I lived in Washington, D.C. to Montreal, the culture in terms of self-care, rest, I'll also say decadence, is a lot more accepted, I think, in Montreal. But that's a huge generalization, I think. But my experience of the two cities is vastly, vastly different. That I feel like in Washington, D.C., there's a lot more of a culture of grinding and pushing yourself to these extremes. Whereas in Montreal, I feel like around me and the culture is a lot less impressed by that, I guess.
Okay, no, really interesting. And what about the French influence as well? Because I know when I've had a few French guests on the podcast before, talking a lot about that kind of pressure to be thin and seems to be quite amplified in the French community. Is that true as well in Montreal, or is it slightly different over there?
Well, it's interesting. So we have a lot of French, the French from France, so European French. I would say we see a lot of that clientele because one of our offices is on the plateau and there's a very high France population on the plateau. But I would say that that culture, of course, is very, very prominent in French culture. I would say Quebecois culture, which they speak French, but the culture itself is very different from, I would say, European French. Less so. It's less diet culture oriented. Obviously, we live in North America in 2024, so there's a lot of diet culture, but I just feel culturally the pressures are a lot less. The Quebecois culture is a lot more, I would say, welcoming and laid back. And again, very much generalizing, but that's my experience of it.
Yeah, no, sure. Thanks for sharing. It's really interesting. Obviously, you've gone down the sort of dietetics route, and as a kind of wounded healer, as myself, kind of going into this space after recovering from eating disorder, disordered eating yourself. And was there something that particularly drew you towards working in perhaps dietetics rather than other areas within eating disorders?
Yes, I think when I received treatment, what year was it? In the early 2000s. When I met with a dietitian, it was very much food oriented. So we met, I chose food off this menu. I was speaking about this weekend. If I chose too much of, let's say, the scone, it was like, well, you should vary because you can't just have the scone. And I just really liked the scone and I wanted it. I guess my push towards dietetics was that I really wanted to approach nutrition that is foundational to healing from an eating disorder, but from a lens of giving people agency, choice, a voice, and perhaps allowing clients to explore their relationship with food more from an emotional, psychological level rather than solely focusing on what I would say numbers, so meal plans and weights. And at the time, I'm so grateful for the treatment I received, but I think in some ways it was very damaging in terms of my recovery progress because my goal weight was calculated based on my height and I'm 4'11". So it was too low for my natural body. I also have Latin American roots and my mom's Egyptian. So you kind of see how the classic BMI just like did not work for my body and doesn't work for most bodies. And then it was just very much like, well, here's your meal plan. You eat enough to weight restore and now you're healed and you're on your way. And I just felt like my healing at least was a lot more complicated than that. And getting to a place where I do call myself like a normal eater. I do not feel tied to my past in any way now, but I kind of did that on my own because in the community, by all sense of purposes, I was healed. That's kind of what pushed me into dietetics.
Yeah, now how interesting. And I think your experience is certainly, I think, what many people experience in this sort of whole eating disorder recovery kind of arena, isn't it? When sort of getting support often actually, it is often more kind of meal plans. It is often very based around sort of BMI and there's less chance perhaps to really sort of dive into more the emotional, psychological kind of perspectives. And yeah, just to really kind of work with that individual really and more with relationship with food and perhaps on the kind of broader healing as well.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. You work with people with eating disorders, and I know you sort of practice trauma-informed nutritional care. So could you talk a bit more about what that means?
Yes. Whew, how do I define that?
In one sentence, please.
I think the way I just describe trauma-informed care, three words, client-centered, and that you ask the client for consent. So I think when I go into my work, my assumption is that my client is not their eating disorder. They're actually a human who is anchored in self. And this disorder actually allowed them to survive whatever experiences that they went through. And they actually are capable of agency and asserting their needs. And I'm there to accompany them to witness their journey. And obviously from my training to offer guidance, to offer suggestions, to question in a way that might help them move towards the life that they want to build. But I think trauma-informed care really centers the client as a human being rather than pathologizing them in their disorder.
So it sounds very sort of person-centered as well, doesn't it? Like in a way, you're coming alongside, you're really being very present, I'm showing a lot of empathy, listening to your client, being guided by them, perhaps rather than coming in as the sort of expert telling the client what to do.
Yes, exactly. And would it be okay if I shared an example, Harriet?
Of course.
I have an example of a client. So I tend to see my clients fairly, I would say longer term, not because they have any obligation, but I think just because of the work that we do around nutrition can sometimes be complicated and I tend to see more complex cases. But for example, somebody who has a diagnosis of atypical anorexia, their whole lives, they've kind of been told that they're fine and their eating actually isn't really that problematic. But then when you actually dig further, you see the things that are contributing to the decision-making around food and physical activity and how fused they are with their disorder. As we kind of explore this and try to rebuild this sense of self, and do you actually, I don't know, like eating carrots or do you not like eating carrots? And what comes up when you're actually consistently nourishing your body in terms of the emotions that you experience? And what does it mean in terms of the rules that were in your household? So I think that when we take a step back and do offer trauma-informed care, we're often able to go deeper and hear and be curious about the client's experience in terms of the behaviors that they're engaging in, rather than looking at the behaviors as the problem and trying to treat those.
Yeah, and it makes a lot of sense. And I guess as well, ultimately, you're going to be really helping your clients to make that change on a deeper level, because of behavioral change, I guess, without really understanding what's going on underneath, it could be quite short-lived, couldn't it? Or sometimes it's almost like kind of like muscling your way through it, really, rather than being able to really step into a new place where it's a sustainable thing to do.
Exactly. Yeah, I call it white knuckling. So very similar, the muscling your way through. Meal plans are very important in some cases. So I don't think that they're all bad, but I think when we overgeneralize and just freely prescribe meal plans, it could actually encourage our client to white knuckle. How can I be a good client versus how can I journey through this to build the life and the relationship with food that I want and get some clarity around how my eating disorder shows up, how it serves me, and how it then impacts my capacity to nourish my body.
So when a client comes to see you, say you work kind of longer term, maybe because you really go to that deeper level, is there a sort of journey that a client may go through with you as they're working on their nutrition and relationship with food?
I often collaborate with a psychologist. We communicate probably weekly about our cases. I think oftentimes when clients, again, a generalization, but when they come and see dietitians, they're very much looking to be told what to do and how to do it. I think that there's this reckoning, maybe, I don't know how many sessions in, but where clients are very frustrated because there's a part of them that they just want to do good and be good. If we offer them perhaps a structure to nourish their body, but then that they actually have choice and they're met with curiosity and there's this deeper exploration, that can bring up a lot of grief, I think, and a lot of pain. But then I think what I see over time, usually it gets more complicated before it gets better. So clients hit this period where they're like, I feel like there's just so much more than when I first started. And for me, that's kind of the opening up the Pandora's box where we go and see how has my disorder been serving me and how has it been perhaps harming my body, but also saving me in other ways. And then it allows them to be more, I would say, introspective about food. So none of my clients are intuitive eaters at this point, but more so that, for example, I have a client that we put a floating item in their day. So this floating item is kind of, you can have it or you could not have it. But then you see this decision-making that needs to happen because you're doing good in air quotes, whether you have it or not, but it offers an opportunity to explore, okay, so why did you choose to have it this day? And why didn't you choose to have it on this day? So our work is always in relation to healing the behaviors as they relate to food, exercise, or body. But I think that a lot of the sessions are discussions around the process and the thinking, decision-making, and the emotional experience around that relationship with food.
Because I think it's so true, isn't it? I think often clients with eating disorders have lost that self-trust, very disconnected with the body, don't really sort of trust their own decisions around food and also around other things. I think they've often like lost their identity, you know, lost their voice. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it sounds like incredibly helpful, but I understand what you're saying as well. Also quite scary, isn't it? When people have to start perhaps taking a bit of responsibility or starting to really think about, oh my goodness, am I going to have this, like, did you call it like a floating snack
item
or something?
Yeah.
When you can make a decision about whether to have that or not, and then think about why you've done it or think about the whole process behind that. Because I think because of all the noise from diet culture, wellness culture, etc., we can all be a bit vulnerable, can't we, to thinking there's a kind of right way and a wrong way to eat. And it's so common. I think that people have really lost that sort of internal trust.
Yes, exactly. And I do think that with eating disorders, I like to call it that they need a container. They do need some guidance, typically, again, generalization, but some guidance in terms of how much is the minimum that my body needs in order to keep them safe and like physically nourished. That container, I think, is very important because if not, it feels, a client said this, it's like, I have no idea how to make decisions around food. I don't know what a normal portion is. I don't know what a normal plate looks like. So if you just tell me like, oh, build it, of course, that's also causing harm. So I like to see my role, at least initially, is how do I offer this like container that is in line with where the client is ready to go and their needs, and also offer some sort of guidance in terms of how much and what. But then there's a lot of movement that can happen once they're able to kind of follow that.
Yeah, and it makes such a lot of sense, doesn't it? I know I often say to my clients about having like a sort of scaffolding with your eating. So it's sort of saying a similar thing, isn't it? But in a slightly different way. But I'm totally with you. Like, I think for a lot of people, they try to sort of jump into maybe intuitive eating and being really sort of free flowing and spontaneous with food from day one. And that's just almost impossible, isn't it? When you've had an eating disorder, it's going to take time to get to that point. It can be a realistic goal down the road, but you absolutely need some structure and safety and that container to sort of get you going, don't you? The sort of safety to sort of hold you.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Because the whole nature of being intuitive is not possible when you're fused with an eating disorder, in my opinion. So clients do have a sense of agency and they can access the self, but there's some healing that needs to happen in order to get to a place where intuition is guided in terms of taking care of yourself and building the relationship that you want with food that will fulfill you rather than reactionary and protective. I think that's why it's not possible, in my opinion, to do intuitive eating when you're actively engaged in an eating disorder.
Time for a short advertisement break. I know that we talk about strategies to overcome eating disorders and find food freedom on this podcast. And I've often shared my story to let you know that you're not alone in the struggle and that yes, you can recover from eating disorders completely. Now, one of my friends, Dr. Marianne Miller, has a podcast that covers similar topics. It's called Dr. Marianne Land, an eating disorder recovery podcast, and I've guested on it twice and I'm lined up for a third time in the coming weeks. Dr. Marianne also had an eating disorder for nearly 25 years, and she went through atypical anorexia, exercise bulimia, and binge eating disorder. She really has a unique voice that speaks not only to people in recovery, but also to individuals in larger bodies. Listening to her podcast will help you find mental clarity and deep-rooted healing that comes from her knowledge as an eating disorder therapist and binge eating coach. Subscribe to Dr. Marianne Land, an eating disorder recovery podcast on Apple, Spotify, and other platforms. Check out the link in the show notes, including the links to one of my guest episodes.
And do you see any sort of difference as well across the diagnoses? I mean, I think with diagnosis, again, it sometimes it can be quite limiting. I truly believe actually that someone's symptoms and if they're causing them distress, that's more important than if you fit in a diagnostic box. But I guess I'm wondering as well, in terms of how you work, would you say it's quite similar as well if you're perhaps working with someone who has anorexia nervosa compared to someone perhaps who has bulimia or binge eating disorder? Or might it be slightly different in terms of how you approach the therapy?
I would say that my approach is generally different. I think there are different things to consider with the different presentations. So I think that my approach differs based on the client's story, their experience, their physical health and well-being, their mental capacity. And I'm less tied to the diagnosis because I don't know for you, for us, Harriet, we can't diagnose as dietitians, which is so liberating in some way because I'm like, okay, I don't need to try to figure this out. But I feel like in knowing the diagnoses, I have clients that could go through all the different diagnoses depending on the time of their recovery, what their current experience is. And I think people are very, very tied to their diagnosis. But for me, it's more, okay, what's happening for you right now? And an example of that is that I think people in larger bodies, oftentimes they will present the same exact way as somebody that has anorexia, but because they're in a larger body, it's like this automatic, oh, binge eating disorder. But actually, when you dig further in the assessment, you're like, oh, you're restricting your intake, you're counting calories, you're compulsively exercising, your body is very malnourished and underweight for probably where it's naturally meant to be. And this is a very natural physiological response that you are now binging every day. But I think somebody in a larger body would have just so much shame acknowledging that typically versus in anorexia, it's like, oh, but of course you're binging because like you're starving. So that's why I'm less kind of tied to the diagnosis and more, how is this person presenting? And then how will I then treat them? I would say one difference is if there's compensation, so purging, laxative abuse, diuretics, those things can be very dangerous and problematic from a medical standpoint. So if somebody is presenting with those behaviors, I will oftentimes try to target reduction or obviously with the goal of elimination, just because I find those can be very worrisome and they're less predictable how it will impact the body. And will it be just this one time that all of a sudden the heart decides that it just can't withstand that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Do you have many clients that present with chewing and spitting? So I know we sort of just mentioned then about purging, laxatives, mm-hmm. diuretics. I think more and more people contact me talking about chewing and spitting, and it's something that's still often not talked about very much or perhaps acknowledged as a disordered eating disorder behavior.
Yeah. So I actually worked at the mental health hospital here in Montreal, and we actually did have, I would say a lot in air quotes, but of chewing and spitting and rumination as well. I would say in outpatient, it presents as a behavior that clients engage in, but not so much like a behavior kind of like, oh, I'm somebody who regularly engages in purging or binging. I would consider it as an eating disorder behavior. And I think I would explore it very similarly to other behaviors in terms of how does this serve the client? What is the function? In my experience with clients, the chewing and spitting is very much related to kind of experiencing the food without having to experience the consequences. So similarly, I think to purging, I would try to reduce and eliminate it similarly to how I would approach purging or use of laxatives and all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds as though your approach is very sort of motivational as well. Like you're really trying to understand, like you say, the functions of the coping strategies, aren't you? To kind of go deeper and really make sense of that with the client.
Yeah. I don't know for you, Harriet, but for me, if I understand how something is serving me, I think it reduces a lot of the shame. All of us, whether we have mental illness or not, I think there are things that we'd like to change about ourselves, but it's really, really difficult. But we can soften that and be curious about it when we understand that there actually is a purpose and a function to this. So it's not this big bad thing that you have to eliminate, but more so in kind of acknowledging it, being curious about it, then maybe there's a bit more capacity that when it happens, we can explore and change how we approach it versus saying, oh no, you did this again. Like, how could you do that? We're working on eliminating it.
Yeah. And I think it's a big piece of the puzzle, isn't it? Reducing shame. And also I think when many clients come to see us, they just don't understand why they're doing what they're doing, do they? They kind of feel like completely like lost almost. And starting to do some of that motivational work and looking at how the eating disorder has maybe served you or kept you safe and really understanding that, yeah, it can bring a lot of clarity, can't it? And open the door to sort of self-compassion, I guess.
Yeah. And I like that it's not so much like, let's get rid of this, but more kind of like when people have slips or I don't love the term relapse, but engage more with the disorder. If we understand that it serves a function, then it gives us the capacity to say like, okay, yeah, but what does recovery mean to you? What does this look like over a lifetime? And when you have more vulnerabilities, maybe let's be a bit more aware that this part of you might try to step in to offer protection again.
Mm-hmm. And what are you finding are often some of those underlying reasons why someone has used an eating disorder as a coping strategy? And I know that's like a huge question. I just wanted to just sort of shed a little bit of light to some of the listeners.
Complex trauma, typically. I think if I had to answer this in a sentence, I think oftentimes with complex trauma, what's tough is that it's not one specific situation where it's like, oh, yes, I can acknowledge that this happened and it was very traumatic. It's like in terms of the attachment, the household, caregiving, how even it goes as far back to like how food was offered in the home. I have an example that I currently cook with one of my clients and we make the same thing. And just she's at her house and I'm at mine. And just the way I put butter in a pan, like she has this very, very strong reaction in terms of her nervous system, because in her home, butter was not just used that freely. So I think it's a lot of these micro experiences that you can't necessarily cognitively identify, but it's this felt sense of, I am not safe. I need to do something to get me to safety. And that's where I think eating disorders are beautiful in some way, because for a lot of our clients, I don't know for you, they've allowed my clients to build really great lives for themselves. They've allowed them to continue to be alive in some instances and survive. So that's why I'm a lot more empathetic and accepting, I think, to eating disorders, because they're very protective in a lot of ways.
Yeah, no, I really agree. I love the fact that you do cooking with your clients, because like you say, when you're kind of picking up as well, actually doing like the act of cooking with someone, I guess, and it just really gives you such a different perspective, doesn't it? To really connect with that person and understand them on a deeper level in terms of how they feel around food.
Yes. And it's given us, this client particularly, and I, like, just so much more information, because, for example, because I'm in my kitchen and she's in hers, she was even asking me like, oh, what food do you keep in the kitchen? All that. And it was just interesting because her reaction was like, there's just so much of it. Like, it just seems like a home that there's like an abundance of food. So just stuff like that. Or I don't know how you cook, Harriet, but while I'm cooking, I'm always eating what I'm chopping or making.
Definitely.
And I do that on video with her. And for her, she's like, oh, I noticed this reaction of wanting to eat this piece of food and it feels so bad and wrong. So these things that we really take for granted, I think, as normal eaters, and somebody would never come to a session and report back to you like, I was cooking something and didn't feel like I could eat the little piece of cheese on the side. But you see that when you're cooking in this like intimate space with a client.
And is the cooking sort of part of it? Is this something that you would do with all your clients, or is it sort of just with some clients? How does that work?
Yeah. Oh, I wish I could do this with all my clients. it would be hard scheduling wise, but what I do, I would say I'm very, very creative in my approach. If somebody asked me like, how do you decide what you do? I'm like, I don't know, because even if you looked at all my food structure, so meal plans, as they call them, they make absolutely no sense if you look at them, because they're very much tailored to the client and their needs and what we talk about and their story. I think the cooking, for some clients, it would be really beneficial. The same way I could like go out to a cafe and buy a donut with the client too, or I do these food exposure groups where we go as a group to a restaurant and eat together. So I think it really depends on who's in front of you and what their needs are in that moment. And I really try to think, what could I do to change this up and offer a different perspective and allow this client to advance in their work? I do a bunch of different stuff.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, it sounds like, doesn't it? I think you're really perhaps trusting your intuition there, aren't you? And working with the person in that very person-centered way and just really thinking what might really help you to have a little bit of a breakthrough, I guess. Because I think talking about all of this can sometimes only get us so far, can't it? And actually, I love the whole like going out to a restaurant or going to a cafe and buying something. Or I think all of these elements can be just so, so helpful in the whole recovery process.
Yes, exactly. And I think sometimes when we think of trauma and the body, I think sometimes there are things that are just felt that are so, so hard to name, identify, and communicate. And sometimes as dietitians or even as therapists, when we are doing and really witnessing the client's experience during that activity, I think it gives us a lot more insight in terms of just what we observe that a client might not always be able to report back to us.
Yeah. So with your clients, use tools sometimes to help them calm their nervous system, get in a more sort of self-soothed place so they can engage in a more helpful way around their nutrition.
Yeah. That's what's kind of interesting, I guess, about being an eating disorder dietitian is that I feel like in dietetics, we are not trained in any way about psychology and the nervous system and mental health. And I think that when you go into this field, it's very important to get training and educate yourself on that. And I think for a lot of dietitians, it becomes very nerve-wracking because we do have a line. Obviously, we're not psychotherapists. We do not do therapy. But I feel like in using different therapeutic approaches, like tools from those approaches, it could actually offer a lot more room for a client to change their relationship with food. So one of the modalities that I love is ACT. And for example, the dropping anchor, I don't know if you're familiar with it, Harriet, but I love practicing, let's say, a dropping anchor or even in DBT, using some of the distress tolerance skills, but it's always in service of helping the relationship with food or with movement or somebody's relationship with their body.
I'm just thinking many of the listeners might not know about sort of dropping anchor. And so could you explain a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah, sure. So dropping anchor is an active acceptance and commitment therapy. But dropping anchor, for example, is when we're noticing feeling flooded. So I think we can all have this experience where there's like one thing after another and you just feel so, so overwhelmed. And it's almost like your body could explode or you just want to scream or you want to do something very impulsively to like get rid of this deep, deep sense of discomfort. Dropping anchor is a grounding exercise. And what grounding means is that we kind of want to connect back to our surroundings to calm the nervous system. So your nervous system at this point is very much like activated. So fight or flight. In grounding, what you would say if a client is in front of you, or if you want to practice this, you would kind of like sit at the edge of your chair, drop your feet into the ground, and really try to connect to your breath and get a sense of your body in the room. And then usually what you're trying to do is like connect back to your environment. So you could say, okay, why don't you try to name 5 things that you see around you that are blue? Why don't you try to touch something that is soft? Okay, do you notice the inhale and exhale? So the whole goal of dropping anchor isn't necessarily to like fix the problem or get rid of the emotion per se, but it's actually just to calm the nervous system so that then we have a bit more capacity to choose how we respond next.
Yeah, no, thank you for explaining that. And Anique, do you utilize body image tools as well as part of your treatment when you're working with people?
Yes, I find body image very complicated in general. Like in terms of treating it, I think the tools that I try to use are more how do we befriend our bodies and become a bit more neutral towards them. So I think outside of the classic like body image, like mirror exposures and all that stuff, I tend to not do that as much. I think it's, is it actually safe to exist in my body? And how do I relate to my body in this way that is not tied to diet culture or my body looking a certain way? Like how does my body serve me in all these other ways? And where did I actually like lose touch with my body and kind of where my body stopped feeling safe to exist in? So I think it's a bit different than, I don't know if this is true, but like the classic body image kind of approaches.
I think as well, body image is a complicated and difficult area to treat, I think, isn't it? To treat, I don't really like that expression really, but I think so much about, I just sort of think with my own healing with many of my clients really, body image healing more happens when one becomes just generally more self-compassionate, more accepting, more body neutral, and then body image sort of improves as almost a side effect of that, doesn't it? Rather than intense focus on the body often.
Exactly. Yeah, I love how you said that, Harriet, because I 100% agree. I couldn't have said it better. I think that's where sometimes we get overly focused on treating body image. But I think if you treat or explore the other things, it's that you actually indirectly do treat it, because life becomes so much bigger than your body, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Best way, isn't it? I think when your life starts to expand and other things like fill you up that really bring you joy and contentment and fulfillment, etc., your body can take a bit more of a backseat, can't it? Or the focus on your body can take a bit more of a backseat.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I know there's so much we could talk about, but I'm just wondering, is there anything else that you would really like to share with the listeners that you think is like a kind of burning kind of thing that you think it would be very valuable for people to hear?
I think what I'd like to share is just that if you feel like food takes up a lot of space in your life, then that is a problem and you deserve care regardless of how sick you think you are or what your body looks like. And that care hopefully can be accessible to you. So there are a lot more programs, I would say, in North America that offer a sliding scale or pro bono care. So I would just, I guess, urge everyone that there isn't kind of a criteria to access care. If this feels like a problem in your life, then you are deserving of care. And hopefully there's somebody that can offer you that.
Yeah, I think so helpful, isn't it? That's a real permission slip. Because I think a lot of people struggle, don't they, with that whole thing. I'm not sick enough, or I don't really think I've got a problem. But like you're saying, actually, if you're really preoccupied with food and it's causing you distress, it's impacting your life, absolutely, you're worthy of care and support.
Yeah, exactly.
So Anika, do you just serve your sort of like local area, or do you like an international organization? Do you take referrals from all over the world?
What's actually interesting is, so we can see clients in the UK, surprisingly. I found that out because I had a client that moved to the UK. So I had to contact the licensing board and everything. The licensing in Canada is that it's kind of provincially. So we do see clients in Quebec virtually and in person, and then a few different provinces in Canada, again, depending on the licensing. And then in the United States, there are various states that we serve as well. So on our websites, you can actually access whether your state or your province can be treated by your team. So if anyone wants to check that out, they are welcome to. And then internationally, sometimes we get requests from other countries, and then we just have to check with the licensing board if that works with our licenses that we hold in North America.
Where can people find you then? If they want to like visit your website or get in touch with you on social media and your team, where are the best places to go to?
Yeah, so we do have an Instagram handle, which is s.o.o.m.a. So Suma, but with periods between all the letters. And then we also have another one called Fueling for Recovery, which is more actually tailored to athletes with disordered eating and eating disorders. And then our website is suma.ca. And then if you go on there, it'll prompt you if you're a US client or a Canadian client. Those two websites are different because they have different information on them. But that's how people, I would say, could mostly find us.
Okay, fantastic. Well, I shall make sure and we'll put the details in the show notes. That's great.
Thank you so much, Harriet. It was such a pleasure chatting with you. I feel like we could chat for 3 more hours probably about all of this.
Yeah, no, well, thank you so much. I think I really appreciated talking with you, really. I'm just thinking, I'm sure, as far as asking you about if you take international clients, because I'm sure so many people listening are going to be like, oh, that approach just sounds like so amazing and really validating and so client-centered. And it's just wonderful to hear about the work you're doing and obviously like the kind of care and intention that you put into your work and just being very creative as well. And you clearly love what you do. So it's very inspiring.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it feels very important to me. And I do care very deeply about my clients and about this work. So hopefully, if ever this little podcast could influence another dietitian, my work here is done.
Yeah, well, I'm sure. Like, I think there's a lot of like dietitians, nutritionists in the space actually that are wanting to work more in this way. So it's just great to have someone like yourself and your team, I guess, who are role modeling this so you can kind of see what's possible. So that's really great to hear.
Yeah. Thank you, Harriet.
Okay, thank you. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation just as much as I did. And do go and check out all of Anique's details in the show notes. If you're not following me already on Instagram, do seek me out at @TheEatingDisorderTherapist_. And for further support with your relationship with food, do go to TheEatingDisorderTherapist.co.uk. If you're a client listening, you may be interested in my online courses, Breaking Free from Bulimia and 10 Steps Towards Intuitive Eating. If you're a professional listening, you might be interested in my one-day online trainings in eating disorders and body image. Links for all the courses are in the show notes. If you enjoy this podcast, I'll be so grateful if you'd follow, rate and review, as it helps it reach so many more listeners. Thank you so much for listening today, and I look forward to sharing another podcast episode with you very soon.